All right, we've got a lot to get to today. We've got to talk about this big Nuggets, Hawks, Nets trade, get to the rest of the signings, and then talk our off-season big winners and losers. But first, this from Soul New York. Thanks to them for sponsoring today. They're one of the biggest bag brands in the company. Started in 2008, and they've shook up a boring industry. And I got their Varsity All-Star Backpack Duffel, which is an incredibly versatile bag. It's small, it's lightweight, it's got a handle on the side, it's got a handle on the top. It transforms into a backpack as well. Got a compartment for shoes. I could fit my basketball shoes in there when I go and play basketball. A foam roller, all my equipment. Works great as a weekend bag as well. You can use it like a backpack. You can use it like a duffel where you can unzip the top of it, pack stuff in there almost like a suitcase. And the quality is just fantastic. Just the mechanism on the zipper, you can tell it's not going to break. It's got nice pulls on it, so it's really easy. It's not going to catch or anything like that. It's just a really high quality piece of equipment. Head to solo-newyork.com, solo-ny.com/capspace. They've got hundreds of designs and you get 25% off. That's solo-ny.com/capspace for 25% off. Well, Danny, obviously the place to start is this big trade that came down the pike last night. What were the details?
So these were two separate transactions that relied on each other. It might actually be structured as one when it all comes to the league office. As far as I know, the call has not yet happened. But so it's good to talk about it in order because one move was necessary to make the other one possible. And so the first one, which was in some ways the more surprising move, was Brooklyn trading Jeremy Lin to the Atlanta Hawks. In that deal, the Hawks, as compensation, received the 2025 second round pick of the Nets and a second round pick swap in 2023. So those are pretty decent, you know, they're pretty far down the line. We don't know if they're going to be good or not. We don't know how these teams are going to be 5-6 years from now. And then also Isaiah Cournier, who we actually saw back at the Hoop Summit, I think in 2016, he was also in the deal going from Atlanta to Brooklyn. That doesn't matter a whole lot. But what that move did is that gave Brooklyn sufficient cap space to then get Kenneth Faried and Darrell Arthur from the Denver Nuggets. And they also, in that trade, received a top 12 protected 2019 first round pick, Denver's own pick. And then for touching purposes, they sent Isaiah Whitehead to Denver, and Denver's going to waive him, it sounds.
Yeah, he had actually moved it. His guarantee date back,
which is great for Brooklyn, actually. Yeah. I mean, they could have used something else for touching, but I mean, good that they had that.
Let's start this from Atlanta's standpoint. Lin, 10% trade bonus, which I'm guessing he signed in Brooklyn as a free agent. I don't see him waiving to go to Atlanta. Certainly Atlanta can absorb that, but that bumps him up to as much as $13.8 million next year. The Nets actually have to pay that trade bonus, but he'll count at $13.8 on Atlanta's books. Expiring contract, but of course you'll recall that he tore his patellar tendon in the first game of the year against the Pacers last season and has been injury plagued, though was effective in his first season with the Nets. And so this is a 2025 second round pick. Atlanta presumably sending that pick because they believe that is the time at which they will be the best and that pick will be worth the least. The Nets sent that 2025 second round pick to Atlanta, and so presumably the Nets thinking that they are more likely to be good then. And then there's also that pick swap in 2023. Again, the further away the pick just in general, the less it's worth, and then especially in this case with the Nets still mired at the bottom of the league as of now, you would have liked to have gotten those picks earlier. And so it really seems like my only explanation here for this trade from Atlanta is that they value Jeremy Lin as a basketball player at as much as $13.8 million next season.
Right. And there's an idea that I, you know, like with the Nene test that I try to get out there, which is the idea of whether a player on that contract is an asset or a negative. That is always team specific. It's good to think about in the abstract because that gives you an idea of whether a guy can be moved or not. But there are specific circumstances. And that's what makes this so weird to me is that Atlanta was one of the few teams remaining in the league that had significant cap flexibility to make a move. And they essentially cut that space in half by acquiring Jeremy Lin. So now I have it that they have about $11 million in space, and you can't do nearly as much with $11 million as you can with $25 million. And not only that, but they also gave Brooklyn the flexibility to do that and to make the move that Brooklyn ended up doing. So Brooklyn took on about $20 million in the Denver trade in expiring contracts and got a first-round pick. I don't think Denver had a particular rooting interest in who was going to do that trade. Atlanta could have easily done it instead. said. And I think that Brooklyn's return in this overall transaction is significantly better than what Atlanta got. So thus, the reason that Atlanta did this trade is because they wanted Jeremy Lin.
Now, maybe you could say, and we'll get to, of course, the Denver and Brooklyn components of this as well, but maybe you could say Atlanta, hey, you know what? We've already got our own 2019 first. We've already got this Dallas top five protected first that'll probably go in 2019. We've got this top 10 protected pick from Cleveland for the next 2 years from the Kyle Korver trade. So do we really need a fourth first round pick in 2019 when 2019 maybe not even going to be the best draft? You know, maybe that's not useful, but I don't know that Jeremy Lin is useful either, right? And maybe the thought here with Lin is he can play, we can rehabilitate him, we'll swap him at the trade deadline and take on some salary for 2020 for teams that are trying to clear cap space for the summer of 2019. So this deal is not over yet. You know, we'll see what ends up happening. They obviously had to meet the salary floor and do that in some way. Supposedly, their plan is to keep Lin. He also has the ability to play some at the two, has done that successfully in his career. And certainly now, despite their protestations that Dennis Schroeder could play with Trae Young, that's always the hilarious thing that gets said when they draft a new point guard over an incumbent. This, in theory, like protects them for trading Schroeder or whatever, but you know they're going to be bad anyway. I don't think they needed some great backup point guard option this year. This almost reduces their leverage with Schroeder. Now there's really just no way you can keep Schroeder. And so they probably weren't finding a particularly hot market for his services, with Schroeder having still another 3 years left on that contract at $15.5 million flat. He's got some incentive as well that doesn't seem likely to meet as of this point. So we'll see what ends up happening in an eventual Schroeder trade, if that even happens. But now it seems like they just, you know, they're going to just send Dennis Schroeder home at this point now. I don't see how this helps them in terms of their leverage, because the idea that we could, even though everyone knows that it was BS, this idea that we could keep Schroeder if we're not getting the trade offer that we want, you know, now you can't even fake that.
Also, unfortunately for Travis Schlenk, he can't trade Dennis Schroeder to like Cheska Moscow. It has to fit in within the NBA's rules, because there just aren't that many teams. As Schroeder's not a bad player, for sure, but he makes a lot of money, and even though it's flat, it still is onerous for a lot of these teams that are looking, you know, with starry eyes at 2019-20 or anything else. And so Schroeder 15-5 for the upcoming season and the two subsequent seasons. But it's hard to be super inspired by that. And also, we've seen a lot of teams, not every team, but a lot of teams kind of figure out what they're doing at point guard. And there are still some available. This to me, with the sequence of events that have happened this year, makes Phoenix a more interesting option, especially now that they've given Devin Booker that max contract. Their space in 2019-20 is now less valuable because they have less of it, something Atlanta is now very familiar with. But again, I don't know that Phoenix sees that as just like an awesome thing for them. You know, like maybe there might be common ground to make a deal, but then you have to figure out the terms and everything like that. And so it's a very fraught situation for Atlanta that they don't have leverage, and they don't have leverage because Schroeder's not a great player, and presumably they're going to give Trae Young playing time. So waiting into the year isn't going to do that. Maybe a team's point guard gets hurt. It's kind of like the Marcin Gortat situation in Phoenix years ago, where they ended up getting assets from Washington and he ended up staying on the Wizards for years. But it's a very curious move. And I think there was an open question about whether Lin, as well as he performed in those early Brooklyn days, like how he fit on this contract. And then the fact that he's coming off of basically two significant injuries in the last couple of years really lowers that likelihood and increases the risk for Atlanta. Not that they're necessarily worried about being good this coming year, but that's why you gave up half of your cap space for somebody.
Yeah, so we'll see. And maybe Lin is going to help them be too good this year as well. It's really a total head scratcher. And Travis Schlenk, I've appreciated the overall approach, to be sure. You know, this is a Hawks team that is lightly disguising their process-like rebuild at this point. Schlenk clearly was hired with the idea that he was going to come in and tear everything down. They desperately needed that when he came in. But we'll see how his coaching hire works out in Lloyd Pierce. They lost Mike Budenholzer, who was a good coach. I think the writing was probably on the wall once he was stripped of his team president duties anyway. The Dwight Howard trade for Plumlee really didn't make much sense. I think it's pretty clear to me that they would have just been better off waiving Howard at this point or trying to buy him out than taking on Plumlee, who goes all the way through 2019-20, which Howard, of course, did not. I mean, they felt like, all right, we got to get Howard out of here. We got to send a message. He's been miserable. But, you know, again, you can just buy the guy out if that's the case. And I think they actually, as I recall, gave up value in the second round to do that, to get off of him. This one was a total head scratcher. Also, they weren't, they signed Ilyasova and Bellinelli, weren't really able to get anything for those guys last year other than some more one games. I thought they did do a nice job in theory of, if they didn't want Doncic, creating a market for him and getting that trade to move down and get their guy Trae Young. We'll see whether Trae Young, who's heading up and down summer league, ends up looking good enough to justify that deal as opposed to simply taking Doncic in that spot. So doesn't make a ton of sense so far, especially this one. Again, this deal is not totally in the books yet, but you know, what if Lin gets injured now, right? I mean, and if you're looking at it as a way to get better for this year, well, there are probably other point guards on the market who they could have paid a fraction of this price to, who were as or more reliable than Lin. Lin's a very good player when healthy, but again, we don't know if that's going to be the case coming off this torn patellar tendon, and he's unlikely to be nearly as effective. That is a pretty devastating injury.
One small note, Bellinelli was actually included in the Dwight Howard trade. He wasn't signed, but that doesn't help. You know, like, Atlanta acquired him, and then he did, you know, he was fine for them, but they got zero in return. And remember, he did not have the veto power that Ilyasova did, and they still got nothing for him. And also, remember, part of why it might have happened that Bellinelli stayed on their team is that, like Memphis, they didn't want to take on salary for the 18-19 season, because, hey, look at what we can do with the cap space. And then they end up burning half that cap space on Jeremy Lin. So it's another team that kind of was thinking about the opportunity cost of that. And yes, it's true, you know, there is a value to what something could be, even if it ended up not working out. That's always true with cap space, with anything else. But I mean, they ended up doing that. And this also ties in with something that I find very interesting with the way this offseason is going, which is, I wondered if we were going to get evaluation on teams getting out of bad multi-year contracts. And we got a little bit of that with the Brooklyn-Charlotte trade, with the Timofey Mozgov-Dwight Howard deal. But other than that, those teams have held firm, and there are some unique circumstances that lead that to making sense right now. And that those teams didn't need to get off of 18-19 space and that bad 19-20 salary. They only needed one. And so they're not paying to do both. And so teams like Atlanta, where Phoenix ended up to a point, they ended up losing out because I think other teams were more rational than I expected them to be.
All right, we got to get to this from the Nuggets standpoint, from Brooklyn's standpoint. But first, this from Lumosity. I know that the people who listen to this program are inherently curious. They like exploring new ideas. Lumosity, the world's most popular brain training program, was built for people like you. My fiance actually has been using it a lot since we were introduced to it. She's really been enjoying it. She had been using another program earlier, and once she got introduced to Lumosity, she liked that a lot better. The way you can get started with them is you could take a free 10-minute fit test to get your baseline scores and see how you compare to others your age, and then you can start training. They're built on a foundation of research and expertise to help you feel confident in your mental abilities. And with Lumosity Premium, you can even follow a personalized training program based on 60-plus cognitive games and activities that are meant to challenge your key abilities, memory, speed, problem solving. You can hone a balanced set of skills, or you can isolate one skill that you want to focus on as well. The choice is yours. The way to get started with them is with Lumosity, LUMOSITY.com/capspace. Easy to remember, /capspace. We talk about it all the time on the program. That can sign you up for the free fit test, and you can get 30% off Lumosity Premium. Once again, that's Lumosity.com/capspace. Take your free fit test and get 30% off Lumosity Premium. That's Lumosity.com/capspace. Let them know what that /capspace URL that you came from us. Because we're negative people, let's turn now to Denver to recap their portion of these interrelated deals, which may eventually be a three-team trade. They sent out Kenneth Faried, Jarrell Arthur, a 2019 protected first-round pick. It's protected in the top 12 all the way until 2024. So it'll go at some point to the Nets, almost certainly, unless Denver experiences some complete disasters. And the top 12 here is interesting because, especially in the West, Denver has been at 13 2 years ago, Donovan Mitchell, 14 this year. They did at least get Michael Porter there. We'll see how he ends up looking. But they've barely missed out in the playoffs. So if they end up in that range, Brooklyn still will get it, with the West being more difficult, with Denver trying to get the playoffs. I think the Nets did well to make this top 12 protected instead of lottery protected. You always want to generally get picks earlier. This is the only pick that Brooklyn has in the quiver outside of all their own picks, amazingly, having those going forward. There's also a future second. Do we know what year that is, that second?
I don't believe I've seen it.
Well, I can continue with it see if you can find it. But Faried and Arthur, Faried $13.8 million this season, Arthur $7.5 million this season. So you're looking at a little over $21 million in dead mid-ish salary. Fareed is going to have some discussions with the Nets today, find out whether he's in their plans or not. They're going to sign Ed Davis, so I'm guessing probably not, you know, unless they want to play him at power forward. Fareed's really best as a small ball center. I still think he is someone who's gotten a little bit of a bad rap. You know, the emergence of Jokic and all the centers in Denver has kind of made it difficult for him to find playing time, but I think he can help some team as a backup center, see what kind of shape he's in after really not having played much these last 2 years. But this is mostly a salary dump. And all right, a first round pick and a second of indeterminate value protected, probably gonna be, if you want to say the Nuggets are gonna be better next year, you know, call it projecting as, you know, the 17th pick, the 19th pick, something like that. That's about right, you know, for that $20 million in salary. That's kind of what we've been talking about with the rule of thumb in this new cap environment of these last few years since the cap spike. So this trade in itself seems about right, you know, but and I think that given how much salary they had to get off once they brought back Will Barton, remember they also had to move Chandler, who's overpaid, but again, a guy who can still play, older, has some chance of falling off a cliff, however. They gave up another second in that Philly deal. But they did well just in a vacuum to get off of $33, $34 million in salary, and still, like, they probably still can't really have much room to sign guys below the tax. It's amazing how high they were once they had re-signed Barton. And also, considering that other teams knew that they had to do this, it was pretty obvious that they wouldn't be paying anywhere close to that amount of tax once they had re-signed Barton. So that's all fine. You know, this individual deal is not terrible, but there are just a number of things about it that are, have got to be very depressing if you're a Nuggets fan. Number one, couldn't they have just tried to move Arthur for some lower level assets that wasn't a first round pick? And then you might have still been in the tax, but that's a reasonable tax payment. And this is a Denver ownership, which has been nowhere close to the tax. I mean, even under the old CBA, they were below the minimum salary. They would get up to the minimum salary technically, but still not actually paying out the minimum salary in terms of contracts that year. They should have banked a ton of money. And the party line, when you talk to their management, was, oh, you know what? Okay, we are going to have to pay the tax for 1 year, but, you know, ownership is willing to do that. Well, that was clearly bullshit, or the ownership changed their opinion and they weren't willing to pay the tax at all. You know, you could have held on to Fareed this year. They didn't want to stretch any of those guys. They didn't want to just pay the tax for 1 year. Ownership said, hey, you know what? No, we are going to give up a first round pick rather than pay money. That is about as anti-competitive as it gets. This is an ownership group from the Kroenkes from Walmart that has billions and billions of dollars. If it were about competing, they could have just paid this for 1 year. I realize there are sometimes, you know, if you're Charlotte, it doesn't make sense to pay the tax. Your ownership just can't afford it. But it clearly is not about competing in Denver. They still don't even have a G League team in Denver. And so the Kroenke group owns a lot of teams, and the Nuggets are clearly towards the back of that group, shall we say. So they weren't willing to pay the tax. So that's a big ownership problem here. And you gave up a first round pick. We'll see. Denver, you know, they don't do too good when they give up these first round picks, do they, Danny?
Oh, you just really want to pour it on them, don't you? Because they're the last team to ever sell a first round pick. They sold the pick that became Rudy Gobert. I mean, that's one.
And then Donovan Mitchell last year.
Yeah, well, that was a tactical trade. I think that was a little bit, you know, that wasn't to dump money or anything like that. That was because they wanted Trey Lyles. They made a mistake, but that was.
But if there's ever an organization that's just like, hey, you know what? Like, we probably shouldn't trade away first round picks that should have had that hammered into their brain.
You know, like, I mean, the whole don't trade with Masai Ujiri kind of idea, but the other way.
Yeah, it's just like, all right, you know, just because they traded away picks that became great players, that doesn't mean that this pick is going to be that. But it's just like, maybe you can learn your lesson a little bit there. And yeah, they have a lot of young guys. They have Michael Porter. They still have holes on this team, though. Like I said, they still have no one who can defend on the wing long-term on this team. So that's very disappointing for ownership, because they have banked and banked and banked profits by being extremely cheap when they were bad these last few years. And then they're going to be a cap space team next year anyway. I mean, this, I guess trading away this first round pick does open up some larger amount of cap space now. But I think a topic that I'm sure will warm your heart is, all right, if you are management, and perhaps management really was under the belief that they would be willing to pay the tax this year, and when push came to shove, they just weren't. And I'm not saying they should have kept Chandler and Arthur and Fareed. You know, that would have been an astronomical payment. I understand getting off of Chandler, we weren't too critical of that. But if you could have just moved Arthur, then it would have been like a manageable amount of tax. But assuming that they knew that ownership wasn't willing to pay the tax, that really sets some of these moves that they made over the last couple of years into stark relief as well.
Right. And I think the most notable one there is Mason Plumlee, because they had all the leverage in the world on Mason Plumlee. Plumlee. He was restricted free agent. His qualifying offer was at a level that they would be totally happy with, and they paid him more money and gave him more years than the market dictated. And those extra years probably made it harder to trade him. They already had Nikola Jokic, and playing those guys together never made any sense. They did do it a little bit this year, and I think a little bit the end of the year they acquired him. And I mean, also, you know, the whole trade that in the first place, we were very critical of that trade. They gave up a first round pick to give up Yusuf Nurkic. So you have all that. But I want to talk about two different other parts of this trade, which I think are important. And I will echo all of what you said. And so these are in addition. So a way of thinking about this trade is sort of similar. And I'm not saying the severity or anything is the impact is the same. I feel a little bit about this trade the way that I did about the Harden move when OKC traded him, where it's like, okay, if for whatever reason there was a directive that James Harden needs to get moved, this was a pretty good piece of business to do it. You know, the giving up a first round pick, getting those two guys, getting below the tax, all that's fine. However, my beef is with the process that led to that decision. And so you brought up the assets. And so, yeah, it's a 2020 second round pick. They gave up their 2021 in the Philly trade. So now they're out both of those. And the first round pick, obviously, top 12 protected from here to eternity. They'll give that up at some point. But not only that, this is a team that finished ever so close to the playoffs last year, despite dealing with injuries and everything else. And they got materially worse. Like, it's not like they sabotaged their team or anything like that. But Wilson Chandler, even if he's not as good as we hoped he would be, he still helps them. They signed Torrey Craig ostensibly to kind of replace that. Kenneth Faried is a depth piece, or Arthur, you know, that's a little bit different right now. But those are players who would have made them a deeper, better team. And they're being largely replaced by young guys who could end up being good. I was a fan of Jared Vanderbilt going back to the Hoop Summit, but he's a rookie. He's probably not going to be nearly close enough to figure all that stuff out. And so they are right on this borderline for the playoffs. And remember, the Lakers now are significantly better. I think you would have them in the mix. OKC largely stayed the same. And maybe if they can be healthier next year, we don't know that. So Denver, it's not like they improved so much internally that you're saying, oh, well, they're a lock for the playoffs. They're going to be so much better than they were last year. I think they could be. I think there's a very good chance they will be if they stay healthier. But these moves on the margins matter for them. And so they got worse. And as you said, this is a one-year thing. That is very, very different from a franchise that's like looking down the barrel of a significant bill for a long time. Oh, we can't get better or anything like that. These are all expiring contracts. All the $30 million or so that they gave up, all those guys would have been off their books anyway, unless they chose to re-sign them, which they could have done, whatever happens with that. And then they would have been in exactly the same position. So it's incredibly frustrating because it didn't make them a better team and it would have been temporary. So just take your medicine 1 year, even with all the other mistakes they made, and you would have been fine. And they weren't willing to do it.
Yeah, so you mentioned Plumlee. That one, they traded a first-round pick, remember, just to get Plumlee, along with Yusuf Nurkic. Again, you know, a little bit of revisionist history there because, you know, Nurkic is better than Plumlee, but he was a cancer in the locker room. And then, of course, they doubled down on having traded Plumlee. They paid him in a center market that existed only in their own head. So, and you could look at it, if you choose to, as, well, now they've almost given up two first-round picks for Plumlee, right? Because they wanted to trade for him, and now one because you took on the salary that you couldn't afford and knew that you couldn't afford. I mean, they signed Paul Millsap last year. They knew that this Jokic raise was coming. I also heard it suggested somewhere that they should have just, none of this would have been needed if they had just kept Jokic on that team option. Yeah, I don't think Jokic would have been too happy making the minimum that you had the option to pay him $25 million and he would have been unrestricted after that. Probably don't want to alienate him there. He is your best player.
And beyond that, you don't have the ability to retain him, and what you're getting with that, this is similar to Gordon Hayward, is the fifth year, and Jokic is young enough where he might not care about that. Like, really, it's the 8% raises versus 5%. The starting salary would have been identical, and so you're taking an absolutely gargantuan risk by letting Jokic hit unrestricted free agency. Yeah, that part of this offseason is not an issue. And they also did another nice move where they actually got Isaiah Thomas for the minimum. I mean, this is a sad turn for Isaiah, who, you know, we're not too far removed from the Brinks truck comment from him being in the MVP voting. I don't think he deserved to win or anything like that, but him having that massive positive impact for the Boston Celtics in the 17-18 season. Sorry, the 16-17 season. And also, so he, at the minimum, Denver, I mean, I do think that they're in a different situation than some of these teams. Like, we could draw the example of the Warriors with DeMarcus Cousins, former teammate of Isaiah Thomas, in that the Warriors can be really, really patient with him. The Nuggets can be, but they don't really have another backup point guard on their roster, so they'll they'll use Monty Morris or somebody else to gap fill. But this, again, players have the agency to do whatever they want. I'm not going to say, because I don't know how all this went. But Isaiah Thomas, it certainly looked to me that he played hurt back in those 2017 playoffs, that he really pushed himself to help elevate that Boston team that still didn't do a whole heck of a lot against the Cleveland Cavaliers. And I don't know if pushing him that way is what caused everything that happened afterwards to happen. I can't speak to that. But we do know that those sorts of things are remembered by fan bases and all that stuff, but it doesn't put a check in your bank account. It doesn't do any of that. And so all of this glorification, it actually parallels a little bit with the KD stuff when people talk about it. All that stuff gets forgotten, and players who don't look out for themselves and for their own best interests are going to face consequences. Whether they are okay with that or not is their own prerogative.
Yeah, Thomas, I think, is a good fit for what they need, although somewhat duplicative of Will Barton's skills. Barton will be their starting three, but presumably is going to play a lot with bench units. He certainly doesn't help the Nuggets' defensive problems, but at the minimum, you can't quibble. I agree with what you're saying about them not really still having that reliable of a backup point guard. One other thing on this trade too, and I've said this a number of ways, because they had a number of ways to get out of having to give up this first round pick. You could also think of this first round pick as, you know, it was fait accompli that they were going to have to give this up once they signed Will Barton to 4 years, $53 million, with a fourth year player option. And so another question that you could ask is, well, would you rather have a first round pick, or would you rather have Will Barton on a 4 year, $53 million contract at age 27? I think that that Barton contract is a little bit of an overpay, especially because he's going to be getting older as the contract goes on. We'll see whether he's able to maintain his efficiency. He's going to have to probably get better as a 3-point shooter as his athleticism wanes. I don't know how I feel about him as a starting three. The numbers there were good, but defensively, I guess they're just kind of giving up on defending the best small forwards at this point. Maybe they feel like Millsap can just slide over and do that. So that's another thing to consider as well. I probably, if given the choice of, all right, I know we're going to have to give up a first round pick to get off of money, or we can re-sign Barton to this contract, which I view as slightly negative value, I probably would have just let Barton walk. And it's so interesting here too, because we had talked about, hey, all of their best players are in their early 20s right now, Harris, Murray, Jokic. And so we said, hey, you know, would you rather have the 2019 cap space to get someone with a better fit than Barton, or would you rather keep Barton around him? And they're like, well, we can't take a step back this year. But you're taking a step back, as you mentioned, by trading Wilson Chandler, and then you're also hurting your future now even more by giving up that first rounder. And I'd be very interested to see if you wanted to make a trade in 2019 with your first rounder, what you could have gotten. Could you have gotten someone better than Will Barton, who fit better at that point? Also, that would have been a question. They're also likely going to lose Paul Millsap next summer. They're going to need to come up with some kind of a replacement for him. So they're going to have big holes at the three and the four, unless Michael Porter can develop into a starting level of player that quickly, or someone like Juancho Hernan Gomez takes a big step forward, or Trey Lyles, whom they're going to have to pay next summer if they do want to keep him around. So there just does not seem to be a ton of coherence here, and they really have hurt their future in a ton of ways, whether it's Plumlee, whether it's Barton, trading the first rounder, moving away from Chandler to, in theory, be better this year, but they didn't really care that much about being better this year because they weren't willing to pay the tax, and they still traded Chandler anyway. So they've hurt themselves both now and in the future. It's really just, again, this one specific deal, I thought they did well enough. This is about the right range, what it should cost to get off of this salary. But the idea, getting into this predicament where you had to move on from this salary and or not being able to pay what I think is a reasonable amount of tax for 1 year, very, very damaging. Shall we turn now to the Brooklyn Nets?
I want to say two quick things. So one, we should also mention that we don't want to get into revisionist history with the Fareed and Arthur contracts. Those just ended up not working out. I think you and I were both fine with the terms of those as they were agreed to when they were signed. So that part of it, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Arthur just like had this weird like illness and just fell off the face of the earth. You would think that probably would only happen to Kyrie Irving, but it figuratively happens to other players as well. But he would have been a useful player for them as a small ball center, as a backup four who could shoot some threes. I think if he had just continued to age at a normal level, I think he was only like 27 when that was agreed to, I don't think we'd be talking about him as such dead salary. He's just has had some weird injury problems. So yeah, I agree with you. I don't think, and Fareed, you know, he was, the game has changed a lot around him, but he's was a quality player, and they got him for what looked like it should be sub starter money at the time.
Yeah, so those ended up just not working out for them, and I want to kind of separate, just to mention that, to give them a little bit of credit there. But let's move on to the Brooklyn Nets, the team that I think a lot of people would start with here, and there certainly is a lot lot to piece together. And this was really impressive. I think they took advantage over this summer, and we'll do off-season grades at a later point, but it's a good point to talk about some of it. They were able to, with these two moves, kind of create an opportunity almost out of nothing, out of another team's mistake, and really get value for it.
Yeah, and the fact that they were able to move on from Lynn at such a small cost, and then they're able to replace the second rounder that they sent. It's earlier, too. I mean, they actually upgraded in terms of the second rounder, their own 20. I'd rather have Denver's 2020 probably than the Nets' own 2025, and hopefully that pick swap with Atlanta won't kill them in 2023. I mean, it's a second rounder, so probably not much is going to kill you there. So they did great. I think this is a team that, other than the Allen Crabbe trade, has been very fastidious about rebuilding. The fact that Lynn is going to be gone, if he was going to play well, at least that's fine. Like, he would have helped you win games. So now they can move fully into the D'Angelo Russell, Caris LeVert, Spencer Dinwiddie era. They have plenty at point guard, even if they don't have any real huge stars there, but they need to figure out what's going on with these guys, especially with Russell coming up on free agency. And if those guys don't work out, well, fine, you lose in the first season when you actually control your draft pick in quite some time. Remember, they had a pick swap with the Hawks from the Joe Johnson deal going back to before the Celtics. So this has been, I think in 2015, when the Hawks had the 29th pick, the Nets had to swap with them. So they had to swap 15 for 19 that year also. And that pick ended up being Kelly Oubre, who was a pretty useful player. I think this is great for the Nets. They have been sticking largely to the plan with a rebuild. It just doesn't impact their cap space next summer at all. If they wanted to, they could flip Fried and Arthur again to take on bad money at the deadline. More likely, they're just going to go into the summer of 2019 and try to compete with the Knicks in the summer of 2019. We've talked about this before, but to reiterate, the Nets are looking at about $56 million or so in room. Joe Harris is going to cut into that a little bit. Also worth noting here from a cap perspective, the fact that they have not signed Joe Harris yet is what enabled them to make these deals, because with his cap hold still only at the minimum, coming off a minimum salaried contract, they had a bunch of space. And then, of course, they were able to augment that by moving on from Lynn. If had they signed Harris already, he would count for $8 million or so. He signed that 2-year, $16 million deal, rather than at the minimum of $1.5 million. So that would have cost them $6.5 million in cap space, and they wouldn't be able to do this deal. So they did a great job of working with Harris, not signing him yet. Also, quick note on the Nuggets here. There's been some talk that, oh, they were able to get below the tax, and now they can open up their full MLE and their BAE, although that could put them again close to the tax. So number one, they might not do that. Number two, they only have one roster spot left. This is the Nuggets. And number three, they've got all these contracts, Gary Harris, Jokic's new contract, that have incentives that they could potentially reach. I think most of those incentives are based on the playoffs. And so they could end up in the tax then as well. So they're going to keep some room clear. And then this is an interesting tidbit for you total cap dorks. Jeff Siegel was tweeting about this, that because the Nuggets already signed Torrey Craig using part of their taxpayer MLE and designated that as the taxpayer MLE, that now they cannot have access to the BAE and the MLE, because once you use your taxpayer MLE, you lose the BAE and the regular MLE. Whereas if you do it the other way, if you use your regular MLE or BAE, not both, of course, and you don't go over the mini mid-level amount, if you get into the tax, you get above the apron, then you can just designate it as taxpayer mid-level, as long as you don't go over the taxpayer mid-level amount. So you can go from the regular mid-level to the taxpayer mid-level in terms of designation, but you cannot go backwards. Once you have used that taxpayer mid-level, if you sign guys when you're over the apron to the taxpayer mid-level, you now have lost the regular mid-level and the BAE, because the idea is you sign someone to this when you're over the apron, and so you can't undo that at that point. So that was just a little bit of minutia there. So the Nuggets really are only going to have, having signed Torrey Craig to $2 million a year, and they signed Jared Vanderbilt as well to a 3-year deal, they're really only going to have about $2 million left of their taxpayer MLE. Basically, you know, just about anyone they would sign, it probably makes more sense to just sign them to the minimum at that point.
Well, and it's also worth noting, this is something Kevin Pelton brought up in his breakdown of these moves, is that while Denver has ostensibly all of this flexibility, because of unlikely bonuses that some would deem are actually...
Yeah, I was just talking about that.
But I wanted to get the full number in that here. With the five... Like, that basically that gets them really close to the tax. And so if for whatever reason, the tax is a real hard line, that explains the difference, that they're not going to use that. And so you think about what that means too, that it's not only we had to get below it, but we can't even have the chance of going over. It seems like they were hard capped at the tax, as opposed to like, oh, we could make a small move, like $1 million or $2 or something like that, a deadline. That happens all, I mean, even the Noah Vonleh trade, for example, last year, like those sorts of things happen. But yeah, it's very frustrating. But let's get back to Brooklyn. I think,
oh, well, here I got one more thing on Denver too. We got Jesus. We're so negative here. Torrey Craig signed 2 years, $4 million. And if they were willing to give out that contract, and maybe if they were willing to just go a little bit more into their taxpayer MLE and go to like $3.5 million, mm-hmm. think of some of the players that they could have gotten. They could have got, like, for a 2 year deal, especially, they could have got like Luka Mbamute. Maybe they could have been in that. And especially given the amount of playing time. Yeah, Ennis, I mean, maybe Ennis has just been told he's going to start at the three for the Rockets. So they're probably not. That's probably going to be Carmelo at this point. But they could have gotten guys who are like real established players who can, you know, and Torrey Craig, at least what we've seen from him so far offensively, he makes Luka Mbamute and James Ennis look like Kevin Durant. And also those guys are way better than him defensively. So, it seemed like really to bring back Craig, who is a favorite of Coach Mike Malone, but I don't think he's really any good, rather than just going out. I mean, even if they were only willing to do a 2 year, $4 million contract, I think they might have been able to do better than Torrey Craig. I mentioned that it would have made more sense, I think, on the last program to try for Ty Wallace first and see if that ended up getting matched, that then they could always go back to Craig, who was a restricted free agent and didn't seem to be overflowing. And then also just with the timing of these deals, if in fact, and maybe this is not true because they haven't signed these guys, maybe they haven't signed these guys yet, but I think they have officially, to have lost your BAE and your MLE, because maybe, you know, they could get onto the buyout market and use some of that later and get off of some money so they wouldn't have to pay the tax.
And these were moves they intended to make. This isn't some sort of shot in the dark that, oh, a team was willing to take it. This was always what they were thinking about doing.
Yeah, although it is worth saying that it's probably difficult to anticipate if the Hawks weren't willing to just make that deal, which apparently they weren't, the getting off of Fareed and Arthur, that, and maybe, you know, the Kings or Bulls had some other stuff working, that they didn't anticipate that this Brooklyn thing would come available, but then Brooklyn unexpectedly, I think we would all say, was able to trade Jeremy Lin and take on these moves. So maybe they felt like, hey, you know, it's not going to be imminent here. We got to sign these guys at some point. All right. So shall we return to the Brooklyn Nets, the side of this that we actually liked for once?
Yeah. So, I mean, for Brooklyn, this does a couple of interesting things. So obviously it maintains their 2019-20 space. They get a first round pick out of it, which is impressive. And, you know, it's the going rate. And remember, this is, by our expectations, this is going to be a decent first round pick. This is not Atlanta getting Houston's. And while we probably didn't expect the Rockets to be the best team in the league, we expect them to be on the high end. Denver is probably not going to be at that level. I think they're going to be on the fringes of playoff contention, whatever year this happens. But so that's a little bit better. You pay a little bit extra for that to get a superior pick. And then also you talked about...
And they had nothing else that they were going to do with this space anyway. Right. I mean, at some point it's like, hey, if we can get a first rounder, we're not doing anything else right now. Let's just do it. And so, yeah, to get for $21.5 million, $22 million, whatever it ended up being, I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, and Arthur, yeah, they can clear that. They could just cut him if they want to and clear the roster spot. Maybe they want to keep him as a vet, whatever they want to do there. And with Fareed, there is a little bit of an overlap if they want to keep Fareed between him and Ed Davis, just being kind of solid vets on a team that isn't necessarily trying to win a lot this year. I like Ed Davis better, but, you know, you could go with that. But Fareed, one really interesting idea, I don't have a candidate in mind, would be theoretically with either one or both of these guys, they could flip them again and just take on a little bit more bad money because they have this wiggle room and they could, I don't think it's going to happen, but theoretically they could. Those negotiations could happen, you know, take on an extra couple million, because if they're going to cut Fareed anyway, if that's what they decide, or they're going to buy him out or whatever, and maybe they just keep him. I mean, he's certainly a useful player. Maybe somebody gets desperate later on, or you could use that as a vessel to take on something else. I don't think they want to take on 1920 salaries, so those options are limited, but maybe that option's on the table somewhere. So for Brooklyn, they get that. They already have lined up everything else, so we'll know that they're kind of done when they sign Harris and sign a Davis. They can basically do that now, because now their space is spoken for. They still, by my math, had enough to sign Kurucs to a deal longer than 2 years. I think I heard that he's going to get four. There will presumably be some heavy options or non-guarantees on the later part of that contract as a second round pick. So yeah, I mean, the Nets to basically build something out of what wasn't nothing is really impressive here. And Mark's just doing the kind of the small moves. I talked about this a little bit actually in when I wrote Detroit's offseason preview about how sometimes having constraints can actually be really useful for a general manager because they operate within those worlds and they say, okay, what's the best thing we can do with what we have? And I think Marks came as he did better on that than I would have expected because I didn't think they would be able to pull this off.
Yeah, and it really is remarkable to think about where they were when Marks came in 2016, that we think he's done just about everything right and they're still not really in a very good position. I mean, do they have one player on that team that we feel pretty confident is going to be an above average starter? You know, maybe Jared Allen is the most likely guy who we think is going to turn into that at this point. And other than the Crab deal, I mean, I think individually we've probably liked every single one of their moves, and they're still going to be reliant on this 2019 pick to really get started. Maybe on cap space, I think they're going to be better this year, which may not be a good thing. Again, they've tried some of these salary taking on trades. I think the Russell trade was a good risk at the time, although if he doesn't work out, then having taken on that Mozgov deal doesn't look amazing, but he was a high upside play. I think that made sense, and Russell of course could still break out. You know, I'm not totally foreclosing that, but the Nets still have such a long way to go to get back into really even being a playoff contender, not to mention being a team that's really, like, you know, a solid playoff team every year. But when you have essentially lost your first round pick 4 years in a row and done pick swaps with teams that ended up having great records, it becomes very difficult. All right, we got to get to the rest of the signings here. This is one of the more fascinating trades we've seen in a while, actually. I enjoyed talking about this for whatever it was, like 40 minutes here. But first, this from Burrow, which has reinvented the luxury couch. We've got one, actually, their love seat sitting in our sunroom. We love sitting on it, reading, relaxing. The cats really seem to enjoy it as well because it's in the sun. They can laze in the sunbeam all day. But really, the most impressive thing about Burrow was just how quickly it arrived, how easy it was to customize it, how easy it was to put together. It really took me like 5 minutes, and that was on my own. If you had a second person, it probably would take even less time. So I said the most impressive thing. That's like three things. These sofas are handcrafted in the same factories as other high-end retailers, but they're delivered for much less, and they're shipped for free. They also have a built-in USB charger, which is nice when you're hanging around watching TV, your phone starts to die, which I know has happened to all of us. You can just plug it in real easily to that charger. You can select the color, the size, the armrest height, the leg color, and they have a 30-day guarantee to try it out, or they have partner showrooms as well where you can check out these couches in person. Go customize your own Burrow, and that will get you $75 off your order at burrow.com/capspace. Easy to remember because we talk about cap space all the time here on the program. That's Burrow, burrow.com/capspace for $75 off your purchase. Burrow makes the luxury couch for real life, and make sure you use that /capspace URL to let them know that you came from us. Where would you like to go next year?
Luke Richard and Bob Mute signed a one-year, reportedly $4.3 million deal, not with the Houston Rockets, but with the Los Angeles Clippers, a team he's familiar with from time with Doc Rivers before. And this is a significant move for a couple different reasons. So one, he is not a Rocket. That is important. He was a key part of their rotation last year. He, due to that shoulder issue, was not nearly as impactful in the playoffs as we expected or hoped, but still, you know, helped their defense stay at such a high level in the regular season, which was a big part of their success at that point. And I mean, if he had hit some layups, he could have been more impactful in the conference finals. And it's funny, you get these people like, oh, well, he's not in the conference finals, so that means he wasn't valuable. That's not the way this works. You look at the whole thing, and we all know he was injured. It's not really a thing. And also, I think this is important for the Clippers because it gives them a defensive forward option. The trio of Tobias Harris, Gallinari, and Mbah Mute is intriguing. Guys with different strengths and weaknesses. You can kind of put them together in different alignments. And I don't think of the Clippers right now as a playoff team because the West is so stacked, but they certainly put together a good roster.
It's really insane how many good players they have. I want to just go through this right now. So their point guard depth chart, Milos Teodosic, who only two more days until his guarantee date, but as we mentioned, I don't think there's really a reason not to guarantee him at this point. He's $2 million guaranteed due to make $6 million this year. Pat Beverly, both those guys coming off injury. They also have Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. They still have a qualifying offer out for Tyrone Wallace as a restricted free agent, who, again, I'm very surprised no one has jumped on yet. yet. And it really seems like the negotiations between Wallace and the Clippers have been kind of acrimonious. I mean, with all the players that they have on the roster now, you know, maybe they could just do a David Nwaba and just let the guy go and be nice instead of just keeping him around when you probably don't even necessarily have a roster spot for him. They also have Juwan Evans, who they drafted in the second round last year at point guard. At shooting guard, both Avery Bradley and Lou Williams. Sindarius Thornwell, who played well defensively last year. CJ Williams, who is on a non-guaranteed deal, but actually, you know, played at an NBA level in at the 2 and 3 last year. And then they just drafted Jerome Robinson. So that's five guys in theory who are like actually NBA players at the two. Then at small forward, they've got Danilo Gallinari, Wes Johnson, and Sam Decker. Both those guys haven't played well in some time. So if they run into a roster crunch, especially with Wallace, you know, maybe we'll just see Johnson or Decker get waived. They've also got Tobias Harris, who's kind of a small forward, or kind of a power forward. You mentioned Mbamute. They signed Mike Scott as well, and the reporting indicating that Scott is going to get the portion of the mid-level not reserved for Mbamute. So both those guys getting about $4 million. They got Montrezl Harrell as well, who played a lot of four last year. He'll probably be their backup five now. They've got Gortat, Boban, who has his uses still. And then, of course, Montrezl Harrell, assuming that they can re-sign him. Of course, he's a restricted free agent. We'll see whether he might get an offer sheet or not somewhere. But you have to imagine he'll probably be back there because it doesn't seem like anyone is really that hot on his heels with an offer sheet. But I mean, that's just a crazy number of established players, or at least like first round picks, guys who have some pedigree. And if they were to bring back Harrell and Wallace, that would actually give them 19 players. So who would you want to move on from there? Probably Juwan Evans and Decker and Wes Johnson would be my picks there. Maybe you could just trade Decker. Someone would be interested in him. Johnson, less so. I think he really has never been a favorite of Doc Rivers, and they have so many other guys at that position now. You might as well just move on from him, even if you just have to waive him just to get the roster spot. And, you know, maybe CJ Williams would be the next one to go, or they just wouldn't re-sign Wallace potentially. But it's really remarkable how many guys they have on this team, and so they should be able to compete. I mean, I agree with you. I wouldn't favor them for the playoffs, especially with LeBron now in the West, but they at least can withstand injuries. We know that.
Yeah, they're an incredibly deep team, and I don't really see any consolidation trades in their future. It's possible, but just with the way that this roster was concocted, I think they're going to largely keep it together. And yeah, I'm excited to see where it turns out. Then we can pivot. Yeah,
if I will say this, if they're out of it, I mean, they could definitely make some trades. Now we haven't seen it be possible to get as much of a first round pick for guys who are ending on contracts just for a rental, you know. But maybe Avery Bradley, if you're out of it, you could get a first round pick for him, because if he plays well, because he's got that non-guarantee for next year. And Pat Beverly is someone who could always help a team as well. And Mbamute, if they're out of it, you know, there'll be a ton of teams probably that could use his skill set as a defensive three.
I want to give you a random idea. This would be later, more towards the trade deadline, but let's theoretically say the Sixers acquired Kawhi Leonard at that and didn't involve Wilson Chandler in that trade, or even just because they thought he was better use assets. You could do something involving Wilson Chandler and Avery Bradley like that. Those salaries are close enough to matching. You can make that work, and maybe that would be something. If you added an asset back, that would be interesting for both teams.
Now, there are many coaches who would say, well, yeah, it's great that you got $60 million in cap space for next summer. But how do you have that $60 million? Because all of these contracts are expiring. All these guys are in their walk year. All these guys are going to want playing time. How the hell am I supposed to coach this team with 12 guys on the roster who are all expiring contracts, who are all good and all want to play? You know, that's going to be an issue. I'm sure Doc Rivers is going to have his hands full dealing with that. So this might be one of these teams that looks a little bit better on paper than it ends up being. And there is some locker room implosion. You know, guys like Bradley, Teodosic, who supposedly was a pretty good teammate this year. Beverly is a headstrong personality. Gortat, not exactly known for keeping his mouth shut. Harris is an expiring contract also, though he might be an extension candidate. Potentially, you've got these rookies coming in. So I'll be very interested to see what this team looks like. But they certainly have pretty much guys who can play in every situation on this team. Where do you want to go next?
Let's go to Mbamute's former former team. The Houston Rockets have lost now two of their rotational forwards in Ariza and Mbamute, and they signed James Ennis, 2 years at the minimum, second year player option. And this is a different way of betting on yourself with James Ennis. He didn't take, I damn well hope somebody made him an offer for more money in 1 year, but Houston is probably going to have playing time, whether that is as a starter or as a reserve. We'll see what happens with Carmelo Anthony. And the player option gives him a little bit of protection in case the season really doesn't work out, that he can get, you know, at least the minimum somewhere. And I think this is a good signing for them. It is not a full and complete replacement, but I like James Ennis as a basketball player. I think he could fit in very well there. And I'm happy about it for them. And I do think that, though, that this ties in with what we talked about on the last podcast about this being a cost-cutting thing with swapping, if we want to say it's swapping Mbamute, I mean, you could go with Ariza either way, for Ennis, a clearly inferior player, though he has untapped potential. And it looks like the biggest reason that swap happened was money.
Start with Ennis. He shot 36% from downtown over his career, but only 443 attempts across 220 NBA games in his career. That's not really enough to say whether he's a 30% three-point shooter or a 35% three-point shooter, but the lack of volume, I mean, last season, 1,604 minutes, only took 153 threes, which was a career high, shot it at 33%. So he's not really looking to jack threes that much. That's going to change in Houston. His job is going to be to hang out. And I think generally, we saw this with Mbamute last year, D'Antoni's system, Houston's system, has been kind to guys just saying, hey, your job is to shoot the ball. PJ Tucker is another one who's somewhat of a reluctant shooter. But usually, unless your name is Corey Brewer, they're able to get guys open shots and give them the confidence to let fly. So I think generally guys have shot, if not a higher percentage, at least a higher volume, enough that they have to be guarded out there. And I think Ennis can at least get to the point where teams aren't going to just be like, oh, hey, we're going to leave this guy open. Also, Houston, of course, reported as the front runner for Carmelo Anthony. And it appears like a trade to the Bulls or a wave and stretch from Oklahoma City are really the only options left at this point. It's been floated, perhaps, that Anthony for Felicio could be something that would be done. And maybe that's why the Bulls removed the qualifying offer of David Nwaba to make that trade work. And I think the last thing that we have to talk about here, you mentioned the tax. Tillman Fertitta in an interview with ESPN's Tim McMahon saying that the luxury tax hasn't come up in one meeting. And so they just call it like the luxury tax in meetings. I mean, there's no way that some of these moves not matching or Ariza's contract, for example, weren't motivated by the tax.
Yeah, that's definitely frustrating as those of us who want to see the best teams be at their absolute best. And we'll see. Hopefully it works out for Houston. Hopefully Ennis, you know, that they can piece all this together, but we'll have to.
We can also discuss a little more reporting on the Clint Capella situation. Tim McMahon reporting that Houston's offer to Capella was 4 years, $60 million. 5 years, $75 million was reported by Jonathan Fagan of the Houston Chronicle. Again, we talked about this last time. Very unlikely to me that they could ever hope to get a deal for him in that range. Capella wanting Rudy Gobert, Steven Adams money, $25 million a year, and I am totally with him on that. Maybe you take a little bit of a discount because the market just isn't necessarily there this year, but it's not exactly, I think, a realistic offer from Houston. If I were Capella with that kind of money, I mean, it almost makes sense to just take the qualifying offer at that point.
Yeah, or try to get one of the teams that still has cap space to at least give you a shorter term contract to lock in a little bit more. But I mean, he'll get that money on the open market. Remember, next year, there are a ton of teams that are going to have cap space and Capella would be unrestricted. So he'd get paid somewhere. It would probably, if it weren't the Rockets, be a suboptimal circumstance. But if he get paid, I mean, we can prioritize whatever the heck he wants. Somebody who is making rumored Clint Capella offer money is Derek Favors. Derek Favors, and we got the terms on this, which I find really interesting. You and I talked about when we heard that the second year of this was non-guaranteed, that what we wanted to see was the guaranteed date. And the guaranteed date ended up being July 6th. And so that is a pretty good date, I would say, for the Utah Jazz, because they will have a good idea of where this is going. They won't know everything. I mean, you won't know everything by the 6th or even by, you know, the 3rd or wherever. But it's a whole lot better than like June 30th and everything else, especially with the flexibility that Utah, paralleling this offseason, the flexibility that they could have for next year. So I think that worked out well. And something that I didn't know, maybe this was something you knew, was that not only is Raul Neto's second year not guaranteed, I think it's $2.1 million, it also has that 7-6 guarantee date. So the Jazz have a lot more flexibility than we might have thought on July 1st. And also with Favors, you could say it's less impactful because I think he's worth that money anyway. So you could trade him to somebody else. This has happened before, but it's still really good for their own flexibility just because now that option is on the table.
Yeah, I mean, you could even imagine Favors, if he does get waived, getting claimed. Although generally it seems like that doesn't happen if a guy doesn't want to go there, that you just get claimed.
Yeah, they would more likely he'd get traded in that circumstance. But either way, it could happen.
Yeah, and that again, just indicative of the leverage that teams had this year. And I think the Jazz, knowing they weren't going to use cap space this year, did well to get him on that favorable contract. And the way, of course, that they did that was by giving him a larger annual salary, really, than he could have gotten anywhere else for this year. And so Favors decided, hey, it's worth it to get more for this year. If I have this slightly later guarantee date, so be it. So that must have been an interesting matter of negotiation of, all right, how much more are we going to have to pay you in the first year to get the guarantee date that we want, to get the non-guarantee, et cetera. That's must have been rather interesting. Would have liked to have been a fly on the wall in that negotiation. We'll move to San Antonio now, where it turns out the report of Davis Bertans getting 4 for 20 was incorrect. It's actually 2 years, $14.5 million. This one for the Spurs, they actually could have cap space next summer, but that would likely mean that Kawhi Leonard had been moved on from his cap hold to be about $30 million next summer. If they do keep Kawhi, they'll almost certainly be operating as an over-the-cap team. And this seems fine for Bertans. There's not a ton of opportunity costs. They're not really looking at the tax anytime soon. They did at least get him back in the fold at 26 already. Maybe it makes more sense to just make this only 2 years and pay him a little bit more than that reported 4 for 20. And who knows where that number actually came from. Maybe that was something else that was on the table, but doesn't really make much sense to bother comparing it to that. But 2 years, $14.5 million for Bertans. What do you make of it?
I like this less because it gives San Antonio less control. I mean, granted, if there's some sort of differing guarantee on the last year, then that would certainly change it. And it's more money per year. So now, you know, the upside value of him just really becoming a clear-cut rotation guy or even a starter over a couple of years, that's not there. They'll still have bird rights at the end of this contract. So I like it a little bit less. I still, you know, doesn't have my ire up because I like Bertans. I just think this is a little bit much for him. But I do like this meaningfully less than the original reporting.
Yeah, and it's always nice to have guys on contracts that are tradable. I'm not sure that this gets there. I mean, this would be the type of contract, maybe you would have a third year on it, that you would have expected more to see in the summer of 2016 than now. And Bertans is an important part of their rotation. It does seem like a little bit of an overpay. Maybe it's an overpay so that you only had to go 2 years. But if you're going to compare Bertans to, say, Joe Harris, who signed a very similar contract, I'd be much more interested in Joe Harris. So remember, the Nets probably had to overpay Joe Harris a little bit so that they could use his small cap hold this year. And they did that on the first day of free agency, and Joe Harris was unrestricted and he plays the wing, as opposed to being restricted and it being much later in the process and the Spurs really having no reason why they needed to get him to agree quickly and then wait as Harris did with that small cap hold. So this, I mean, compared to some of the other deals that were signed this year, this does seem like a little bit of an overpay. Not a killer, but big shocker, the Spurs overpaid one of their own guys.
We also found out that Bryn Forbes is returning on a 2-year contract. I haven't heard the exact terms, which makes me think it's low.
Yeah, Forbes' qualifying offer was $1.7 million, the minimum plus $200,000 for that particular qualifying offer. Qualifying offers are for guys who don't make the starter criteria and weren't first-round picks. It's the greater of 125% of prior salary. That was the Nemanja Bjelica qualifying offer this year that the Wolves ended up pulling. Or, in the case of Forbes, the minimum salary, which would have been $1.5 million this year, plus $200,000. So his qualifying offer was 1.7. Sorry, I'm in explanation mode since we're in the middle of a sports business classroom right now. And that's one where, as long as it's not too much money, which it doesn't seem like it's going to be, seems fine to me to bring him back in the fold at around the minimum. I think he's, you know, would you rather have like Bryn Forbes or Ian Clark? I probably actually would rather have Forbes because I think he has a more versatile jump shot. I don't think either of them are great defensively, but I like Forbes a little bit better. Clark is a better cutter, maybe has a better floater game, but I don't put a ton of stock in that. So to bring Forbes back at the minimum, he's in the Spurs system, didn't kill them, can't really play in the playoffs because he's too short as a shooting guard. We saw that in that Warriors series when he got ball racked all series. But to bring him back for what sounds like a pretty minimal amount is fine work there from the Spurs.
We also got unsurprising reporting, but still important to note, from Darren Wolfson earlier on Friday that Jimmy Butler has officially turned down the extension offer from Minnesota. Now, Minnesota was limited since they couldn't clear enough space space to do renegotiation extension. They were limited to offering 4 years, about $110 million. It makes sense that he would turn that down because that is significantly less than Butler could get as a free agent. We will have to see how that impacts it. I know those who are risk averse it would depend on the relationship with Tibbs and Butler and talking about contracts. I mean, it is pretty dangerous to walk into a final year on a contract where the player can leave as an unrestricted free agent. Minnesota can certainly offer more money than anybody else can by that fifth year and by a higher raises. So we'll just have to see how Minnesota handles this. And I'm very interested in that. And then they're also presumably talking with Carl Anthony Towns about an extension, but nothing has happened yet there. So we can't really talk about it.
Yeah, this is one I'm usually more along the lines that players should take extensions than most. But that $110 million, I think actually it might have ended up being less than that because Butler got a signing bonus, as you'll recall.
Oh, that's right. That might have been true.
Contract with the Bulls. So they're building off of that. I think the actual amount would be closer to $100 million. And so considering he'd be eligible for a five-year $189.7 million contract, that's a lot of money to give up. Now, for a 29-year-old, is that offer going to be forthcoming for the Wolves, a team with tax concerns? Maybe it'd be less. But you also have the risk of Butler, if you extend now, that you're locked into the Wolves. I mean, it's going to be a huge free agent market. You could go play with LeBron James. It's rumored he wants to go play with Kyrie Irving. And so when you throw in the risk of, hey, $80 million less, maybe even more than that, and you're also, and even the four-year contract with another team would be 4 years, $147 million. So you're still costing yourself at least $40 million there just based if you go to another team. So totally understand why Butler wouldn't want to lock in right now. It doesn't seem like he's particularly happy with his teammates in Minnesota. And yeah, he has some injury risks. He's coming off the surgery. He has some performance risks, but hard to believe that there are just about any circumstances in which Butler wouldn't get $100 million. You know, maybe if he tears an Achilles or tears an ACL or something, that's really the only way. Unless he suffers a season-ending injury, I think he'll be fine there. So I think if in his circumstance, totally understand why he is turning that down. Got a few more things to talk about here. Also want to talk our winners and losers. But first, this from a familiar sponsor. Been around on Dunked On for a long time. They've supported us. And as we've grown, they've grown like crazy as well. The copy used to say they sold over 1 million watches. Now they're at almost 2 million watches. And they're sold in 160-plus countries as well, which is a great way for international listeners to support the program with movement.com. MVMT.com/capspace is that URL. You can get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns. Their watches start at just $95. And I never really was a watch guy because the watches that I liked didn't really seem to be in my budget. They're $400, $500 at a department store. But if you go to that movement.com, MVMT.com/capspace URL, just scroll through their watches and see. I think you'll find something that you really like. I'm a fan of their 40 series. I like a little bit smaller of watch. The 40 stands for 40 millimeter. But they've doubled their number of watch styles. So definitely go back there, see what you can find. My mom loves buying them as gifts for men or women. My fiance has one as well. They've also got sunglasses and women's bracelets available. So they are constantly expanding. Check out that collection that they have at movement.com/capspace, mvmt.com/capspace. Use that /capspace URL to let them know that you came from us and join the movement. A couple other small things here before we get into our winners and losers. We talked about Malik Monk missing 6 to 8 weeks with a thumb injury. A further review has indicated that his thumb is not fractured. I don't think he played again in summer league, but at least he's going to have an off season. He won't have his progress retarded the way he did last off season with that ankle injury. And then the Bulls, we touched on this earlier, rescinded the qualifying offer for David Nwaba, a very odd move on its surface. That again, his qualifying offer only $1.7 million. He's a guy who can play. I don't know how much long-term money they want to commit to him because they have this 2019 plan, as the Bulls have had, whether it's 2014, 2016, 2019, they always have some year plan. But according to Casey Johnson, the waiver of Sean Kilpatrick and the revoking of the qualifying offer, which today was the deadline to do that, so they did that at the last possible instant, is a precursor to other moves. We don't know what those are. Maybe that could be a Carmelo Anthony trade. Maybe it could be a restricted free agent offer sheet. And they could always potentially, maybe they have a deal in place to bring back Nwaba on the room exception after they use their cap space as well. So very interesting to see what the Bulls have cooking here, although getting excited based on something that the Bulls might do would be something that could cause you a lot of angst over the years.
It's somewhat appropriate that Wayne Ellington has been put in the kind of the end of this podcast, considering that's kind of how it's been for him in free agency. He signed a 1-year, $6.2 million contract with the Miami Heat. I have no idea why he never really got traction in this market. Talented shooter. I mean, he's bounced around a lot in his career. The breakaway podcast that Rob Mahoney did on him is in some ways even more interesting now after all this, because they're talking about him finding a home in Miami. And the Heat now, with this signing, I have them at $231,000 below the luxury tax line, but they still have to sign a couple guys. So we'll see how it works out. They could, of course, make other moves. They could also just pay a small amount in the tax, but I want to see where this goes with them. But getting Ellington for 1 year at that price is great. I actually would have, I mean, maybe he just didn't want to take multiple years with the price so low, but Miami did well.
Yeah, and Ellington at age 30, you would think that he would be someone who would want to lock in for more years. Maybe that offer just wasn't there for him. Certainly, if you are the Lakers, if you are Philly, you have to say, hey, maybe we should have made an offer for this guy that could have beaten this Miami offer. Maybe Ellington turned those down and then the market dried up on him in a way that he didn't necessarily anticipate. I think he set a league record for bench threes, over 200 three-pointers last season. He's a really versatile jump shot. This does create, again, the same logjam that the Heat experienced last year, but they've got Deion Waiters, in theory, coming back from that ankle surgery. Still no word on Dwayne Wade. You would have to imagine that Ellington's return makes it somewhat less likely, perhaps, that Wade would return. There also could be a trade, though. Worth noting that Ellington now, because he finished up a two-year contract, this would be his third year. He would have full bird rights if he were to remain in Miami. If he were traded, he would lose those. So he has the ability to block a trade should he want to. But you would think that of all those guys, Waiters might be the most likely to go there. He's got 3 years at over $12 million per season left. We'll see if he can come back and play well. He's really only had one good season in his career of offensive play, and then obviously suffered the ankle issue, and his three-point shooting, his long two-point shooting in that 16-17 season was quite unsustainable. But hey, at least Miami did something. They also signed Derrick Jones, who's looked pretty good in summer league off of a two-way. What else we got here?
Something that's weird to me, the Lakers signed Lance Stephenson, so it looked like the terms they'd agreed to were 1 year at the room mid-level exception, and they signed him using cap space instead of just waiting, using that cap space on other guys and signing him afterwards. And it probably doesn't make a big difference, but this kind of ties in with the Denver thing where it might, is you can only sign somebody with the room mid-level exception to a two-year contract. And so you might be saying, oh, well, the Lakers aren't signing anybody to long-term deals. Well, they got Bonga and Svi Mihaljuk, their second-round picks. They signed them on longer deals, and you just never know where a value play is going to be. And so the question that I have is, why tie your hands unnecessarily? You've agreed to terms with Lance, and there's not really an issue. I mean, we're seeing other guys like Ed Davis wait, and it maybe they're not planning on using the space anytime soon, so maybe on the buyout market or something like that. But it's just kind of one of those, with knowing what the limited amount that we have right now, it just seems like an unnecessary rush.
Yeah, I don't think it's really going to hurt them either way. And you know, if Lance is going to go and play pickup and drive baseline and dunk on a guy who looks exactly like me, it was pretty funny. Haverstraw had a funny tweet about that. He wants to feel secure that his contract is signed so he can go out and humiliate poor Nate Duncan looking saps. In Golden State, they've had a couple of departures from their lower level staff. Their trainer, Chelsea Lane, is moving to Atlanta. Semi Gelfand, their analytics liaison with the coaching staff, he's moving on to Detroit. And then Golden State also signed Steph Curry's potential future brother-in-law, Damian Lee, who was waived by the Hawks to a two-way contract. Lee had been in Golden State's G League affiliate in Santa Cruz. Lee is a developing shooter, has a solid athleticism, someone who might be able to come in and fill in on the wing. We mentioned that that's really the one thing that Golden State needs a little bit more of, is two-way guys in the wing, and maybe they can develop Lee into that. And, you know, at least you keep Steph Curry happy as well by having his brother-in-law in the fold. Anything else we got to talk about here, or should we just take a little bit more of an overview of this summer that has gone so quickly?
Oh, let's get into the summer.
Well, let's talk about who, like, what free agents are left.
Oh yeah, let's do it. We don't have to go the team by team step, but we can do remaining free agents.
Yeah, well, and we could talk briefly just about who has some cap space left if there have been some major changes. So let's start there since I have it in front of me. Atlanta, still about $10 million or so in space. They have a couple of non-guarantees that could bump that up to 11. As you mentioned, the Bulls sitting right about $20.6 million in space with the revocation of David Nwaba's qualifying offer. And again, I think that would be just enough if they wanted to trade Cristiano Felicio for Carmelo Anthony. Cleveland is kind of still in limbo. Have they had a single signing? I don't think they have, but they've got Rodney Hood out there still. It's either Hood or they have their full MLE, but really no one to use it on. Dallas has $4 million or so left with Dirk Nowitzki still out there as a free agent. He'll either get, whether it's the room exception or the remaining cap space, whichever is larger. Indiana still has a couple million out there in space, depending on whether they waive and stretch Al Jefferson or not. I'm not sure whether they did that. I haven't seen reporting on that. And then the Lakers, they've got their room exception remaining among some of the major ones. Sacramento, still $19.5 million, a Zach LaVine-sized chunk of room sitting out there for them. And anyone else I'm missing who really, you know, I guess Utah still has their full mid-level.
So does Orlando.
Again, it doesn't really seem like there's anyone to use it on. Yeah, Orlando, that's another one. Sleeping giant in free agency, Orlando Magic. And you would say maybe, I mean, I don't know what the Magic have planned for this year. Do they want to tank or what? But you would think that they would have offered Isaiah Thomas a little bit more than that, and that Thomas would have been interested in going there, given the fact that I think he could have had a larger role than in Denver. We still have no idea what Thomas's health status is, whether he'll be ready to start the season or not. And he would have been competing with DJ Augustin and Jerry and Grant. Maybe that Grant move, they want to get a look at him, and that foreclosed Thomas coming to Orlando. So I think that's about it in terms of the significant space out there. How about just in general the remaining free agents on the market? I think everyone knows who the restricted guys are, so we can just talk about the unrestricted guys.
So in the unrestricted market, let's start with point guards. Shabazz Napier, to me, is the best player available still. If you want more of like a depth guy, Devin Harris, Shane Larkin, a lot of the older vets, you know, we could go through all those guys. On the perimeter, non-point guard, Dwayne Wade, Travion Graham, favorite of the podcast, Jamal Crawford, Pat Connaughton, Corey Brewer, now David Nwaba is there. Vince Carter, I think, could definitely help a team if he, depending on what he wants to do here. It's also interesting with Carter and Wade that we haven't heard anything about retirement. I wonder what their conversations are. And then in terms of bigs, Dirk, but we think that's pretty well settled. Monroe, Alex Len, David West, Bebe Noguera, Mike Beasley, Trevor Booker, Channing Frye, Vonleh, Jahlil Okafor, Dante Cunningham, who I think is would be interesting for a lot of different teams. And somebody could take a roll dice on Big Sauce, Allen Williams, or Al Jefferson.
Al Jefferson signed with China, as you are so fond of saying. So we can we could take him off this list for now.
I wonder how that's going to turn out. That's interesting, because usually it's those high-volume perimeter players that end up doing well there. Or most Bates. But most Bates counts as a high-volume perimeter player, so he still counts. But we'll see how that works out.
Yeah, I think Vonleh and Noguera are two of the more interesting names among those big. Channing Frye, I think. Did you say Frye?
I hope I did. That was part of the plan.
Yeah, he's still out there. And most of these guys are looking like they're going to sign for the minimum. And then on the restricted free agent bigs, Capella and Montrezl Harrell are really the only ones remaining. Probably the biggest name out there of anyone right now, Smart and Parker, the biggest names, I should say, are out there. And so, yeah, I mean, we'll keep it relatively truncated here, because we're going to do, of course, a full offseason grades in the next couple of weeks here for each conference. That'll each be a separate podcast. But overall, you know, biggest winners of this offseason to you, just kind of more in an open-ended, it could be a player, it could be a team, could be a class of players. What comes to mind?
The Golden State Warriors title odds for 2019. I think that's the biggest, for those who care about that element of it. Paul George staying in Oklahoma City, LeBron going to a Lakers team that looks like it's not going to be in title contention, the Rockets getting weaker, Boston at this point not really doing anything to strengthen, they're going to be a quite good team, and we'll see what happens with Philly as well. You know, I think they're better, but I don't think they were a title contender last year, so we'll take a lot of improvement. So I think that's the big one. I mean, for those who care about that, I don't think it's inevitable, and I noticed that the words DeMarcus Cousins did not factor in that early stage at all. He could end up helping. We'll see where that goes. He could end up, if they feel pressure to play him, hurting that in certain circumstances, but I think overall they'll get that balance right. But I don't think it necessarily swings as much in terms of the title odds after 2019, because the Lakers still have so much flexibility. We still don't know what the hell is going on with Kawhi Leonard. But 2019 title odds, I think it's stronger for the Warriors now than I would have expected.
Certainly the teams in the East that don't have to deal with LeBron James anymore, that's a huge one. I think Brooklyn has done pretty well this offseason. You know, we'll see on Dallas, but I think getting Doncic, getting DeAndre Jordan on a one-year deal, that seems pretty good. You know, I'm not sure who else they were going to get with that money that would have been better, at least to make them better this year. They should be significantly better, although obviously the West is going to be its usual bear next season. This isn't really necessarily a winner or loser. I guess I could say that 2019 free agency, just for us as fans and how interesting it's going to be, is kind of a winner, because you've got all these teams with cap space, all these players going for 1 year deals. As I mentioned, I think it was Mark Stein who tweeted this out, that about 60% of the deals that had been signed as of a week ago were 1 year deals, which is just very unprecedented. And we were critical of teams for not signing guys to longer deals, but it sounds like in having some conversations, Zach Lowe also wrote about this, that some of these 1 year deals are really more player driven because this is such a bad market. And I think also for players, having watched everyone else get paid and then feeling like you're getting screwed over by this 2018 market, to still be able to have the potential for riches instead of taking a longer term deal that's going to pay you a little bit less. But we could use Tyreke Evans as an example here, right? You would assume that the Pacers would have been willing to offer more than 1 year at the amount that Evans got, which is about $12 million. But Evans said, no, I want to get back onto the market next year. Again, these are assumptions. I don't know this for sure. But for me, if I'm Tyreke Evans, you know, maybe you should have taken that an offer to go a little bit longer. I mean, Zach said, hey, players correctly are taking 1 year deals. And obviously, it's a case by case basis. But I would quibble with that a little bit, especially when we're talking about potential life changing money. I mean, Tyreke Evans just had a career season. What's to say that he's going to have a long term offer waiting for him at $15 million a year next year in Indiana when he's going to be coming off the bench? He may not shoot the ball as well. He's struggled with injuries at times in his career, though he was healthy last year. But let's remember, he was healthy last year and he basically played two-thirds of his season because the Grizz were tanking so incredibly hard. But there are going to be a ton of players on the market. There's going to be a fair amount of cap space. Right now, I have the league-wide number, not including exceptions, at $574 million, which would be about 2.5 times as much as there was this year. And you've got a bunch of teams slated to have over $50 million in space. I've got it as five teams that are slated to have over $50 million in space. But with so many players on the market, there still could be some who would fall through the cracks. I mean, we're never going to have, I don't think, I mean, unless people roll over again on one-year deals to 2020, as many players on the market. I mean, I think I want to say like almost half the league is going to be free agents next year, something like that. Have you seen anything on that? I can't remember where I read
it. I haven't run the numbers on it, but it's a whole lot. I mean, it's going to be a ton of players, and there will be flexibility too in terms of guys the option decisions are going to be very, very different this year.
So yeah, that's going to be an interesting trend. And then, you know, losers are the coaches who have to coach all these guys on 1 year deals. I'm sure they are not going to be too happy about that. I mean, I've never seen any empirical evidence that teams with guys on expiring contracts actually do worse, but certainly anecdotally, coaches will say that guys who are on 1 year deals who are playing for contracts are harder to coach.
A couple other winners I wanted to bring up, guys that got paid even though it was a narrow market. Zach LaVine getting his big money. Will Barton, I think, got a contract that looks good.
Oh, yeah.
Jeremy Grant got paid a lot more than these kind of rotation level guys. Ersan Ilyasova got paid a lot more than his counterparts kind of in that backup power forward range.
Doug McDermott. Basically, everyone I think who agreed right on July 1st, if you were a player, probably did pretty well. And we'll see whether those players who signed longer term deals made the right decision, or whether everyone in 2019, guys who aren't as good as them, end up getting way more money than they do. But obviously there's a price to be paid for security as well. If you're a McDermott who hasn't made that much money in his career, Will Barton was on a 3-year, $9 million contract before this. This is a life-changing payday for him, and good job by him and his team certainly to hold out for more money. They got it. It was a risk certainly, but you know, the Nuggets do tend to overpay their own guys, and they made the right bet there, even at the expense of having to get off of money and give up some assets to do so. They really were focused on keeping Will Barton, and Will's going to get a chance to start now apparently at the three. I think that's about all I got, unless you had any other directions you want to go. I mean, obviously we'll get much more into the aftermath of this offseason when we do our grades. Also, another podcast we have coming up that's going to be fun is going back and regrading the 2017 offseason. We're going to hold ourselves accountable for what we said in last year's offseason grades. I actually was re-listening to that podcast earlier today. There's a lot of interesting stuff to go over, see how stuff looks a year or so in hindsight.
Yeah, the only other thing, just as a plug, I'll mention is, so I wrote that LaVine piece for the Bulls. You can think about that. Is I'm going to have a bunch of stuff now that I'm back home settling it out, but Real Jam Radio will come out at some point before the next Dunked On. I don't know exactly when that's going to be, still working on it, but you can listen to that, and yeah, and we'll have more stuff coming out in the near term.
All right, thanks again for listening. Don't forget about our sponsors. Make sure you enter those slash cap space URLs, let them know that you came from us, and we'll be back early next week. Till then.